There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th podcast. I am Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here with my co-hosts, Susan Simpson and Sara Basha. Say hi, ladies.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson.
Hi, this is Sara Basha.
This is our first episode where we are switching to a weekly podcast, and I hope our listeners are excited about it, and we are excited about it. And we also have planned, as we've announced in the past, some great guests. We just this week also started doing listener messages, and for those of you who haven't picked up on that, please do call into our listener line. Listen to the end of the show, and we're going to repeat the number there, leave your messages. So we've got some great listener messages we're going to listen to today. But let's start off with, since we're going to weekly, just start off with a little bit of a roundup about what happened this week.
What didn't happen?
You know what? It's like a year has gone by. A lot's happened. All right, Susan, why don't you tell us about a little bit about what happened this week?
So it's a good thing we put off talking about the new healthcare bill in last week's episode because right before we recorded, it apparently turned out that there's not going to be a new healthcare bill.
At least not for now.
For now.
Yeah, it's not over yet, though.
We will see what comes next. The end of the day, it turns out that despite, what is it now, 7 years of complaining about it, they didn't actually have a backup plan to replace the bill that was enacted back in 2010.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's fascinating about this, that the reason it really, the bill never made the floor, I mean, they didn't even take a vote on it, was not even because of Democratic opposition. It was this internal GOP opposition. And what I'm surprised is like that, hey, you guys internally didn't talk it out this whole time. It was the Freedom Caucus, I think, that really killed it. Killed its chances.
It proves to you guys that we're not all crazy lopsided in our approach to things. And that there's dissent and there's differing opinions.
But the Freedom Caucus is even crazier. I mean, this is what I think.
Well, you know what's... I think what surprises me is the administration's attack on them. And they're supposed to be the, you know... the epitome of what the party means. So
I think it's virtually certain that Trump has no idea what was in that bill.
Yeah. And I personally think that Trump doesn't give a... I really think Trump doesn't care at all. I think it was a talking point, something to get voters behind him. But I don't think he really cares at all about healthcare one way or the other. I think if Obamacare stood, he'd be like, oh, well, you know, everybody's suffering because of Obama. Don't blame... His line is always, don't blame me. The thing about the attack on the Freedom Caucus, I mean, like, it wasn't just him saying, you know, blaming them. He's like, I'm going to hold you to task in 2018 and you might lose...
Not just that. Treat you like the Democratic Party.
Right.
Well, listen, it's part of the checklist. And he does say that, you know, it's all exploding or imploding. But I think he actually said exploding. So
he said both. Yeah. It's exploding and imploding.
I mean, okay, well.
Hedge all your bets.
And that's the scary part, though. I mean, as a president, it is his job to faithfully execute the laws. And he can, you know, support changes to the laws. There's nothing wrong with that. But if he's actively trying to undermine existing law, and to cause harm to the American healthcare system so he can win political points, which he's announced he's going to do. The fact no one blinked at that is a really disturbing sign of how far we've come from our normal democratic norms.
I mean, because that's the kind of thing like a child would do, and I just expect that behavior now. That, you know what, if I can't have it, I'm going to break this toy. I don't expect anything other than this kind of behavior from him. But we're going to circle back to the issue of Obamacare, Trumpcare, with a fantastic guest coming up in a couple of weeks who works with the Veterans Administration and is a doctor himself. So stay tuned for that conversation. But that's not all that happened. It's not just that Trumpcare died. Many other things took place this week.
Okay, tell us about what's happening with Mike Flynn and Nunes. That's been interesting.
Yeah, Mike Flynn has apparently turned state's evidence. That's what I'm hearing. And that's what it seems like through statements from his attorney.
Or is offering to turn state's evidence.
He's offering something.
He's on sale. He's looking for the right bidder.
He's looking for the right offer, but he wants immunity, and he has a story to tell. That's what we know. And the president has also tweeted his desire that Mike Flynn gets immunity. Spicer basically spun it to say that, well, he wants him to get immunity so he can tell his story. So he wants all encumbrances off of him and to make it easier for him to tell his story. What do you think about this immunity thing, you guys? Because I keep hearing the debate go back and forth that, you know, an innocent person can ask for immunity. But then I think, well,
of course, yeah, well, no, but of course they can.
Mm-hmm. You know what's funny, though? I don't think there's going to be anything that that is revealed that's going to make our jaws drop, because I just feel like it's the administration's way of saying, yeah, you know, you should protect him when he speaks, but he's not going to say anything that egregious or life-changing anyway.
I'm curious. Why don't you think he has something interesting to say?
Well, I think he might, but I don't think he's going to – I don't think we're going to find out too much more than we already know. I don't think –
Than we already know.
Yeah.
I think we will. I think there's quite a bit to come.
When is this happening, by the way? When is that going to take place?
Well, they denied it. They said no. They turned his offer down. They're not going to give him immunity.
Who is the they?
I don't know if the FBI is given word, but the Hill is not going to give him immunity.
Okay. I mean, I'm assuming, look, what he really would want is immunity from total prosecution, and that would be only something that Department of Justice could grant, not necessarily Congress cannot grant that kind of immunity from criminal prosecution. But this is my question about immunity. I mean, why would an agency, the Department of Justice, or even any kind of a state law enforcement agency, give immunity to somebody unless they have something big to offer in return, right? I mean, like, you have to bring something to the table. Immunity in exchange for what, right?
Well, not necessarily, too. Especially, like, look back to what happened with Clinton and her aides. Nothing they said was particularly even interesting. But their attorneys rightfully insisted on immunity. Like, that's standard. I mean, when there's a highly charged political atmosphere going on, it makes sense for the attorneys to push for it. And I don't think you can read anything more into the mere fact that someone's seeking immunity.
I just don't think we're going to hear anything that's life-changing, like I said.
From General Misha?
From Flynn. Well, I
mean, General Misha.
General Misha.
His emails. Misha's the Russian name for
Where have I been? That's interesting.
So here's the thing. And you know what? At this point, I'm okay speculating about it. There has been a lot of, back at one of the earlier hearings with Comey and Rogers, they kept mentioning this whole romance angle. Like, someone can be persuaded to act against the country's interest due to romance. And it seemed like an odd thing to keep coming back to, because, like, okay, how is that possible? Like, I mean, the Putin and Trump romance isn't literal, so what are we talking about here? But the questions kept coming back to that, and the state kept going back to this whole, like, idea of romance being a trigger or a mechanism that could trigger someone to act against their country. And a lot of people are reading that to be about Mike Flynn.
What do you mean? Who is Mike Flynn romancing?
There was a story that Mike Flynn was not reporting his contacts with Russian citizens, which, as someone his, you know, head of DIA and all that, they're supposed to report contacts with, you know, foreign nationals, countries, especially like Russia, where there could be a problem there. And apparently there was a Russian student that has met him at some kind of event and struck up an email correspondence with him.
That's interesting. Okay, well, let's see how that plays out. I didn't know. I actually didn't realize that angle at all. I didn't hear about it until now.
Guys, I think today or yesterday we learned that he was sending his emails to her, General Misha.
Is it naive of us to think that Flynn hasn't been necessarily coached on what needs to be said?
Oh, of course he has.
Exactly. So why do you think we're going to hear anything?
Because they've caught him. He's already dead in the water.
I mean, I do think at this point he's going to, I mean, and he, well, I don't know. I don't know how close he is, his ties are ongoing with the Trump administration. What I've read somewhere was that even though he's no longer in his role as national security advisor, that he still communicates with them and he still does advise, like, unofficially or informally. But I wonder if, you know, I mean, I would think that his own hide is much more important to him than protecting the administration, but I don't know.
So the other big thing that came out is the Woolsey meeting, in which it turns out that when Mike Flynn was absolutely not an agent for the Turkish government, he was meeting with high-ranking members of the Turkish cabinet and making plans to basically unlawfully extradite a U.S. green card holder to Turkey. Basically kidnap the guy and take him back to Turkey because Turkey wanted it.
Right. We're talking about...
Do we know who that is?
We are talking about Gulen. We're talking about Gulen.
Oh, yeah.
And Gulen is the cleric who has been in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania for many years. And Erdogan, who is the head of Turkey, feels very strongly that he was behind the coup in Turkey last year. Although investigations, and including an investigation of the UK, show no such evidence that Gulen had anything to do with it. In fact, Gulen and his people who are connected to him strongly condemned the coup. But, you know, he commands, when I'm talking about Gulen, a power over many, many millions of people who follow his movement very faithfully. And I have friends who have grown up like in his schools and in Turkey and have been part of the charitable, have been part of his charitable institutions. And so he does have a lot of power and influence, and he's maybe one of the greatest threats to Erdogan, internally, at least in Turkish politics. So,
and what's interesting too is that in July of 2016, Flynn made statements that indicated he supported the coup against Erdogan. And then suddenly in August, he gets $600,000 from a Turkish businessman, and he is declaring that America's like national interest and priorities must be Turkey, and that Gulen is a terrorist who must be removed from the state.
Well, something that's been happening that a lot of people might not be aware of is that there has been in the last few years this really, I think, a really hardcore campaign by Turkey to win approval in the United States, including lobbying the U.S. Congress to find that the Armenian genocide was not a genocide because Turkey was complicit in it. There's billboards about, you know, the love of Turkey and the friendship Turkey has with the United States and D.C. Close to my house, like 6 miles away, $120 million Turkish mosque project popped up in the last couple of years. It's beautiful, but it is funded by the government. And so the Erdogan government is lobbying very, very hard to gain influence in D.C. and in the United States in general.
Well, it goes beyond that, too. Remember, they had that thing with the Dutch where they were trying to get Turkish expats to support his election campaign. And then recently, right now, we have...
You mean Dutch citizens, too? Like,
yeah, but they, I mean, obviously, it's... I'm not sure if it's Dutch citizens, but I know that...
No, Dutch citizens. They were calling Dutch citizens, like, because of Turkish ethnicity. Yeah.
That's crazy. But then also, right now, Tillerson is in Turkey trying to discuss the whole ISIS issue and trying to create these safe zones for Syrian refugees and all. It's kind of a trying time for, I think Turkey's in a tough spot, and I think it's complicated. But at the same time, we kind of need them, because right now we're asking for the Syrian Kurds to assist with getting rid of ISIS, which means if we kind of join forces with Syrian Kurds, then that helps the PKK, which is a problem for the Turkish government. So it's a really complicated and twisted kind of predicament out there.
There has been, as far as I've heard and seen, nothing from the White House to condemn the blatant free speech and media violations going on in Turkey right now. Like, dozens of journalists jailed. And
Thousands.
Yes, but you know, you guys, this festered during Obama's time. It's just a continuation, because we really need Turkey.
Yes, but it was never in doubt that that was not supported by the U.S. There was a lot of like, okay, we still have to work through anyway, so we're not going to make a huge deal out of it. But at least the statements were there. It was clear that, you know, it is what it is, and we're going to work with you for real politic reasons, but the statements and the sentiment was always there. This is not okay. We're not supporting what's going on here in terms of how you're treating journalists.
I didn't see the Obama administration really clamp down or say much.
Yeah, I don't think they were very strong about
down,
it.
But
yeah.
But this, it was, there was never a question that, you know, all things equal, America would prefer you not to do this.
Right, right. There is that. Look, I think two things here. Number one, I think America, like any government, any nation in the world, is going to look at its national interests, going to look at what serves us. And it's not just Turkey. I mean, there are many, many governments in the world that have treated citizens horribly, and we just kind of hold our nose and work with them, right?
We've been doing that in the Middle East for...
forever, right. Okay. We do that all the time. And so that's every administration. They have to do that, like you said, for real politic reasons. The Nunes story got a little bit weirder. We talked about it last week.
a little weirder, it got
exponentially.
Y'all couldn't see this in our outline for the episode. Robbie and I had like entries made, and it was like what the hell is going on with Nunes? And I'm like, seriously, what the hell is going on with Nunes?
Yes.
Only we didn't use the word hell.
We used, yeah.
And it turns out what was going on is the most embarrassingly incompetent conspiracy in the history of Washington conspiracies.
They're so bad at this.
They're so bad at this. Oh, my God.
Hey, but is this a call for him to step aside or remove himself from this getting louder or no?
Oh, if, you know what? There's been like, what, maybe one from the GOP who are even calling out this obvious disgrace from our government. And that's upsetting to me because there's nothing to excuse what's going on here. And yet, you know, Ryan's like, he's doing a great job to keep him there, even though he's lied repeatedly, conspired with White House officials to falsely portray evidence in the media that led to many thousands or millions of people believing falsely that Obama spied on Trump. None of that ever happened. All of that was false claims engineered by a really terrible conspiracy. And the reaction from the GOP has been, he's doing a great job helping the White House to keep going that way.
I mean, I think, you know, what's happened here is that Nunes's actions have really completely discredited the House Intelligence Committee. I mean, I think everybody's now looking at the Senate to get this right. For people who've missed it, basically what happened was, you know, we know that Nunes was on the White House grounds the night before he met with the president and then had that weird press conference. We don't know why he was there. Now we know that he met with a couple of administration officials, people in the White House who actually briefed him and gave him the documents that then he held that press conference about, the same documents that he said he wouldn't share with anybody else. And then he says he then went and briefed the president. Now, to me, that is weird and circular. I think that is fabricated. Right. There is no way that these White House folks, you know, whether it was the White House counsel, and I don't know who the names are, they went to Nunes and said, now you tell the president. The president set him up. It was a setup. They set him up to be like the fall guy and to say, now go out there and show that you were shown these documents that corroborate our story in that, yeah, something really went down with the Obama administration. They totally set him up.
Yeah. What they needed was a way to show that, one, Trump was somehow right when he said Obama wiretapped the phones in the Trump Tower, whatever. But two, they needed to find a way to do that that didn't actually show anything damaging about Trump.
Right.
So their way of doing it was to have a couple of pretty low-ranking White House guys who, I would be more surprised than anything it's not going to come out this way, but if it came out that they were acting independently on their own initiative, that would be the most shocking turn of events to me. And they have this secret midnight meeting or evening meeting with Nunes, and they show him, from what we've heard, it's pretty empty stuff, actually. It's just transcripts of overheard conversations between foreign conversations, no Americans involved, and these foreign officials are mentioning the Trump administration and their efforts to try and like gain influence or like communicate with them. So nothing, like absolutely nothing like interesting either on the Trump side or on the intel side. But, you know, Trump and his associates were mentioned in his conversation. So that was the basis of Nunes' claim that convinced millions of people that Obama had been spying on the current president.
Well, they're going to be sharing those documents apparently with the rest of the committee, the intelligence committee members.
Yeah, no, Schiff got him, and he said that it didn't support anything that Nunes had said.
See, I started out with this whole thing going, you know, the guy's in a tough predicament. He sort of has to look into this, and it's stressful, you know. But then when he started, you know, informing the cabinet, hanging out with them more, the administration, I think a lot of us conservatives feel like that's not really independent.
Mm-hmm. And I should clarify, when I said the GOP was sort of outrageously and hugely disappointingly supporting Nunes, I was referring to Congress GOP. There actually has been very appreciated pushback on the Senate side, at least. And they have been willing to express their how they're appalled, too, what's going on. But from Congress, as far as I've seen, there's been like one Republican congressman that's said this is not acceptable.
And there's been one Republican congressman who said, well, he works for the president. He does not work for the president.
This is just shameful. This is embarrassment. I mean, even aside from like the danger it represents to the nation, it's just embarrassing that such nakedly political, undemocratic, and untruthful actions are happening in the open eye. And no one from the party doing it in that body is actively caring in a way that could, you know, if cause it to stop or call it out. Like, they're okay with it. At the end of the day, right now, House Republicans are okay with a congressman who is leading an oversight committee to coordinate with the White House to protect the White House and protect the president from embarrassment from his own deranged tweets.
All That's right. where we are. Well, the story is going to keep evolving. So lastly, before I move on to a couple of issues that we're going to dive in a little bit deeper, although I feel like we've gotten kind of deep in these, I just think this is a little bit lighter, but also it's really sparked some really interesting conversation, and even with me and my own friends. And that is, you know, would you dine alone with Mike Pence or
any... Oh, Rabia, come on.
No, you know what? I know this
it's
is...
important, though.
It is important.
Why?
It's
Let the
really...
man do what he needs to make his marriage work for him.
Even right. means discriminating against women because you Why can't work on the road without having dinner with your colleagues.
I don't think All that's right. discriminating.
No, but so let me ask. Okay. Just...
But the women who work for him are necessarily limited in how they can do their jobs because their boss thinks it's inappropriate to be around them. And that's
no, but here, okay.
That's but embarrassing and offensive.
But here's the thing. Look, I am not. I wouldn't say I'm a progressive, I'm a liberal, but here's the thing. I get this, and I'll tell you what my own rule is. I'm gonna share the rules of my marriage here. I'm gonna totally expose myself here. And that is this. My husband and I have come to the understanding, because of our dynamic and because it works for us, that we will not have dinner alone. We won't have dinner alone with a male colleague or any, or even a male, like, you know, or for me, it would be a male, for him, it would be a female, with somebody, a member of the opposite sex. We won't have dinner alone, but we will do lunch and like coffee. And that is like our, so it doesn't prevent us from having the conversation that we need to have one-on-one. And obviously, look, I'm an attorney. I've spent many years representing mostly male clients. Of course, I've been alone with men all the time, you know, in rooms, on boards and all kinds of things. But when I want to meet somebody like, you know, for a coffee or a meal or something, we just were like, all right, we'll do lunch and we'll do coffee, but we won't do dinner. So that's where we are. And it's because of our particular sensitivities between me and him. So while I understand it, and I also understand where you're coming from, Susan.
But you're not an employer is the more important factor. If the impossible happened and Pence became president, he's effectively ruling out the possibility of a female vice president. And that is problematic right. when we have like a woman cannot be vice president.
Wait,
if Pence is
no,
president.
I think you're because, jumping to conclusions. He might.
Wait, you're
just
saying
have
the president.
He might just have another person in the room all the time. I mean,
he has to have a chaperone to be with his vice president.
You know what? It's between the husband and wife. I respect whatever rules they have between themselves. Just like what
or,
Rabia said was her.
Or
so
Susan.
Demeaning.
Hey Susan, how about this? What if he literally means it that he won't have he won't dine, but he'll still meet with somebody. Just no food involved.
That's just,
I mean.
That's incredible. Like, it does effectively mean he cannot have a female in a high position of power where he can, because it's very typical. Look at Trump's schedule, having dinner alone with like Secretary of State or other people. I was going to say Chris
right.
Christie, but that was not, he's probably not coming back.
Right.
Like that happens. That's what they do. And it'd be really strange if the vice president couldn't ever do what every vice president's done before, because the president has this rule that women have cooties and he is corrupted if he happens to eat food in the evening in their presence.
Well, look, if he's president, he's probably going to have somebody serving the dinner. So somebody will always be in the room. It's not
oh
a
my
problem.
God.
Right.
The president has to have a chaperone because he can't be trusted alone with women. That's hilarious.
No,
well, the president does. Actually, I would not dine alone with Trump. I'll tell you that. That
yeah,
president does
Actually,
need
when...
a chaperone. Pence, like, I would trust.
I would have dinner alone with Pence if it came up that way. I would not have a problem like being alone in a room with him. I would not have dinner alone with Trump.
All right. So look, I mean, I think that, I'm reading some really interesting conversations on this. It sparked some really interesting discussions online and social media and different things. And many people who also express the same kind of discomfort, you know, I do agree that this is a deeply personal issue, and but I also see how it's problematic. So I don't know how to mitigate that really. But I do think that there might be ways to do it where you're able to meet with a colleague or an employee of the opposite sex in a way that wouldn't make your spouse uncomfortable and doesn't make you feel like you're compromising your marriage in some way. There has to be.
When women have different roles in the workplace, that's discrimination. When you can't actually do the same job a man can because others feel that you're like morally corrupting in your influence, that's not okay.
Oh, wow. Do you think that'll be a lawsuit?
This could turn into workplace issues.
Right,
this is another whole other deep dive.
It is, but it's interesting. Okay, all right. So moving on. So I want to talk about sanctuary cities, which is something that an issue came up this week when Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, brought it up to indicate at one of the press briefings. He came on before Spicer and he talked about how they're really going to enforce this executive order that Trump signed back in January that basically would take away federal funding from cities and states and then any other kind of county, whatever, that is a sanctuary city. So I want to first tell our listeners a little bit about what it means to be a sanctuary city. There's no legal definition of a sanctuary city, but localities will identify themselves as a sanctuary city. Right now, there are four states that identify themselves as kind of sanctuary states. You've got 39 cities and about 364 counties. It's like a patchwork all over the country of places that self-identify as sanctuary cities. Generally speaking, sanctuary cities are cities where local law enforcement will not cooperate with federal immigration authorities. So, for example, the federal immigration, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement asks local law enforcement, hey, we want you to do a couple things for us. When you make a traffic stop or when you come across people in any kind of situation, a crime's being reported, there's a public safety issue, whatever, and you're involved, to ask to get people's immigration statuses and to detain them if they're unlawful. That's one thing they want. Or if somebody's been arrested of crime and they happen to be, they want them to review their status and then refer them to ICE. So, give ICE a notice. And so ICE has 48 hours to come pick them up and detain them for 48 hours. But all of these places that identify themselves as sanctuary cities, law enforcement, for a number of reasons, has said, basically, it's not that we're not going to cooperate with the feds. We'll let the feds do their job. But we're not doing their job for them, is what they say. And there's a number of, a couple of other things sanctuary cities do too, though. And every city and every place has different rules. Like everybody is doing it differently. It's not one, it doesn't look the same. The way it looks in Connecticut looks different in California. Some sanctuary cities are issuing ID cards to people who don't have identification documents. Because if you don't have an identification document, you might not be able to get housing. You can't rent a property. Some places are actually issuing driver's licenses and some places don't. And so, they're all doing it differently. But a number of reasons that law enforcement say that they do not want to work with the feds on this or to, honor their, the requests of federal enforcement is that, number one, it reduces crime reporting. It's very problematic for them when you have immigrants who refuse to report crimes because they're afraid they're going to get caught up in it. It hurts people who might be victims of abuse and trafficking, and they won't report it for the same reasons. Also because they don't have the space in their detention facilities to hold these people. And also, they don't feel comfortable holding immigrants who without a criminal warrant. So there's all these different reasons. And another big reason is because in Oregon a few years ago, there's a lawsuit. An immigrant sued a county and won because she was detained by them for, I think, an extended period of time waiting for ICE. And so they had to pay a lot of damages. And so the legal liability also prevents law enforcement from working with the feds. But now we have this executive order saying they're going to withhold in the billions of federal funding dollars, many Department of Justice grants, basically. There have been hints that they might actually have to pay those grants back. But basically, they'll get no money from the feds if they don't cooperate here. The justification of this executive order and them clamping down on these sanctuary cities is that sanctuary cities are giving shelter to violent criminal aliens, and that they're making things unsafe for the city for Americans. And, so you have these two competing narratives. You have these two competing ideas that, look, if you're law enforcement, you have to keep the place safer, but you're making it unsafer by harboring criminal aliens. All right.
So, Rabia, in my work with civic engagement, I've noticed that states usually make moves on things when they feel that it's economically not viable for them. So I'm just trying to imagine if you're a law enforcement officer and you stop, say, illegal aliens and you're kind of holding them until ICE comes around, there's an opportunity cost that's associated with that. You're actually spending time that you could be actually performing your own job and keeping the city safe in other ways and while just waiting for ICE to get there and finish its procedures because you're having to work with them. So I think as more cities feel that that's impeding on their function, primarily in, you know, observing law enforcement in their particular states and counties, it will get more resistance from these cities.
It's not necessarily, it's not like that sanctuary states are doing this because they want to like protect immigrants or like help illegal immigrants. So that's, yeah. Their goal is that. The goal is much more self-centered in a lot of cases. And also, I mean, it's not just that, but it at core, like you're saying, it is an economic and practical interest in effectively policing their jurisdiction and wasting resources, a lot of resources, on doing a job that's federal government's is harmful to their own citizens, in their view.
And imagine how law enforcement feels when they feel that people are not able to connect with them and don't want them around or unfriendly towards them because they're always associated with ICE. And so they will not only underreport stuff, but they will not even approach them, and they will see them as the outside, the enemy, and not, you know, protectors of society.
It's a really dangerous dynamic with local law enforcement. I mean, I feel very strongly that local law enforcement connections with communities should be that we're kind of all on the same page, right? I'm like that we all live in the same community, our kids go to school together, we shop at the same places, that there is cooperation between local law enforcement. When the feds come in, something really bad has happened. That's how I think about it. And so this does really undermine the trust of communities in their local law enforcement. And they need to partner on a variety of issues. They need to work together on lots of different issues. But billions of dollars of funding, that is kind of a big deal. And at this point, Seattle is the first place to file a lawsuit against the Trump administration. So this is another battle that's going to be fought out in court because they are calling this executive order unconstitutional. And there's a variety of reasons that they've said that, you know, it violates the Commerce Clause, it violates the 10th Amendment, which is the separation or federalism, basically, and the power the states have that the feds don't have. You know, the premise of this executive order and the repeated like rhetoric around this is what really deeply bothers me, because it's completely untrue. All statistics show that aliens, documented or undocumented, commit crimes at lower rates than citizens, right? So we know that these are the facts. And even some of the folks that Trump trotted up on stage during the RNC who are victims or whose family members were victims of crimes committed by undocumented immigrants, like those crimes didn't even happen in sanctuary cities. So they're trying to make this connection, which doesn't exist, based on a premise that also is faulty.
You know what bothers me is that whole bullying aspect of denying federal funding to these cities if they don't comply. It's just so in line with this, if you don't do it, .. you know?
And also federalism. I mean, it has value. Federalism is a thing that's important in how our nation functions, when it's designed to function. And it seems like pretty often federalism is only a thing that matters when it can be used as a way to support a conservative agenda. When it is contrary to what conservatives want to do, it's suddenly not a cool thing to have. And I'm worried that marijuana will be the next, you know, target.
Why are you worried about marijuana, Susan?
I'm not worried about that. Like, obviously, it's much less concern. But I feel like that's another area where we've
totally
just kind of unbalanced, like Obama's White House was not like totally on board with this whole let the states do what they want to do thing, but he didn't actively push it. Jeff Sessions really hates marijuana. I mean, he's on the record saying he liked the KKK until he found out they did marijuana.
But you know, Susan, I think we have a bigger problem in the heroin and opioid problem right now. I think marijuana is not as big a problem.
Yeah, but Sessions really wants to take down marijuana and is threatening to take action against states that have legalized it. Again, that's, you know, on the scheme of things, it's nowhere near as important as sanctuary city fight, but I expect that'll be the next battleground in terms of like this eroding balance between state and federal powers.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, like you talked about, you know, the bullying aspect and whether or not there's coercion in it is one issue that, you know, the court's going to look at, and that Seattle has argued in their filing that this is coercive, and if it's coercive, it's unconstitutional. So let's see how that's going to play out. Okay, so I'm sorry, you wanted to talk about Planned Parenthood. Why don't you lead us into that?
Well, the story of this week for me has been the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion, or the Abortion Insurance Full Disclosure Act of 2017. So I think people have been making this into a bigger issue. And I know people are going to jump on me just because they're going to think that I'm not for women's reproductive rights. But let's just look at this with perspective. Okay. So the Senate is made up of 52 Republicans, 48 Democrats. And they voted on Thursday to let states block federal family planning money from going to Planned Parenthood for abortions, you know, stopping funds going to abortion providers. So Pence broke the tie in the vote, made it 51-50 in the Senate. Democrats criticize the measure as an attack on women's reproductive rights, and Republicans feel that local officials should decide where family planning money should go. So let's look at some statistics real quick. And what's the importance or how prevalent is abortion in this country? In 2014, we had approximately 926,240 abortions in the U.S., and that's down from 1.06 million in 2011, and it's progressively been getting less over the years. So in 2013, we had about 16.7% of all U.S. pregnancies ending in abortion, and that's actually down from 2012 and 2011. And we know that the highest number of reported abortions are occurring in states like California, New York, Florida, and the least happen in Wyoming, South Dakota, and North Dakota. But in general, family planning programs created in 1970, and it serves about 4 million people in about 4,000 clinics. So what happened with this bill is essentially it just cuts the funding to Planned Parenthood and its affiliates in states. Now, my view, and I guess more people will yell at me, but my view is that women are smarter than the black and white view of either pro-life or pro-choice. Okay, those labels are kind of demeaning in my view, because the truth is we need sanitary and safe conditions for abortions that need to take place. But I don't believe in forcing taxpayers to fund people's choices. So
they're not, whoa, why are you phrasing that? You need to back up, because they're not for a long time. They are not funding abortion. What they're trying to do is to shut down any women's health organization that also, without any kind of government funds, in some way supports abortion.
I don't think this bill addresses all the functions of the family planning programs. I think it's specific to abortions, and that's why I want people to stop yelling and screaming.
But they're not paying. But no. Are you saying that it's stopping payment for, like, stopping federal funds from going to abortion services? Because that's not it.
States have the ability to stop allowing or stop using federal funds for abortions. So it's giving power.
No. That never happened, though. This is about the abortions themselves do not ever get taxpayer funds. They're cut off. This is about funding agencies or funding organizations that also separately, without ever having federal dollars, perform abortions.
Right. So Planned Parenthood and its affiliates, essentially.
So basically any women's health organization that offers full comprehensive women's health.
I'm not sure about that. I think the bill outlined that it was specific to abortions only. So taxpayer
But money's never going to the abortions.
Okay, let's what do these programs actually offer? They allow for contraceptives, family planning and counseling, breast and cervical cancer screening, and STD and disease prevention. So I'm not sure that's necessarily going to be cut significantly, but I do know that this addresses the abortion portion of it.
But the abortions themselves never get paid by taxpayer money. That's like off the table, never a part of the conversation.
And by the way,
this is organizations that
it's not directly federal, but the states determine where they're going to put the money, whether they want to put it into the abortions or not.
But okay, but Sarah, let me ask you this. Let me just say this. Planned Parenthood reports only 3% of its services it provides are abortions. Only 3%.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's a smaller amount, and this is whole part parcel of letting states take more control over what's going on. And in a budgetary sense, they feel like that's not so important, because I think local is the way to go. I mean, Planned Parenthood's mantra is usually local empowerment and local community action. So they just have to continue with that municipal and local and state level outreach they do to get the funds they need for certain things. It doesn't
really. But Planned Parenthood is hugely effective what it does. It's trying to target it because a small portion of its services are
right.
Abortion.
And this is, we're all agreeing that Planned Parenthood only has, you know, there's a very small percent of services. 97% of its services are things that I don't think anybody would oppose, like providing treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, for what's called counseling services, things of that sort. And so, if that's the case, but the threat to defund Planned Parenthood is to defund it completely, right? It's to withdraw all funding.
No, not in this bill. This bill doesn't do that. That's what I'm trying to say. People okay. are jumping to the conclusion that it's actually shutting down what Planned Parenthood's doing in terms of the programs.
What does the bill say? What does the bill say exactly about what is going to be taken away from Planned Parenthood?
I haven't looked at the language, but it says basically there's not going to be taxpayer funding, i.e. federal funding, for abortions. And so given that it's on, decreasing over the years anyway, and it's only a small portion of what Planned Parenthood does, I don't think it's going to affect the rest of the programming. Now, I don't know if there's going to be
legislation. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
No, but it does mean they have to stop doing abortions or they get nothing from the government.
I'm not sure about that. I feel that it's left in the state's hands. So now if Planned Parenthood if they actually go and they vet their local reps and their state reps, they could still be open to funding. They just have to make the case for it at a state level and not a federal level. That's all I'm saying. So when people jumped all over that, like, it's just an example. I mean, just look at the outcome of the votes. It was 50-50 and the tie was broken by Pence. So that tells you that even Republicans know the importance of those programs. It's just one portion of it. And, these guys are looking at bills every day. They have to look at the budget. They have to look at where they're cutting. Now, I have to tell you guys, though, I follow my religious beliefs on when a fetus should be aborted. So it should be a choice in that sense, I believe. But I also think that most women are reasonable and somewhere in between on the issue. I don't think it's a black and white thing. So I'm tired of people like politicizing it to the point where they make it look like you're either pro-life, which in essence is like, saying you're, if you're not, then you're anti-life somehow, and then pro-choice, which you can't always, it's tough to be one or the other. It depends on the situation.
The point of this new bill is that it really isn't going to say that, Planned Parenthood is not going to fund 3% of its services involving abortion. It's to say the states can say that Planned Parenthood gets nothing from the federal government.
I think that
that's a huge deal. So basically what the goal of the bill, and the only possible goal of the bill, is to make sure or to put huge amounts of pressure on organizations that provide abortions to make them not provide abortions. Because if they don't, they can keep their funding. So the ultimate goal here is to make it much more harder, if not impossible, for them to actually practically get an abortion.
And Sarah, you have to agree that possibility exists. Like you might be saying may or may not be the intention of the bill, or it doesn't specifically target it. But what Susan is saying is that the possibility exists that this is exactly what could happen. And that is really the scary scenario. Because if you have
I understand why everyone seems to think that Republicans and the GOP actually despise women to the point where women's health means nothing. I mean, everyone has mothers, sisters and daughters. I mean, my point is, I get that.
So do the Taliban. So do the Taliban. Okay, come on.
Listen, I get that it's not a priority. I get that it's not a priority sometimes, and it's for the party sometimes. But I don't think they're going to completely defund it. And I think that perhaps it is better in the purview of the states. I mean, I don't understand why the federal government. I don't understand why I'd have to pay taxes for someone's choice in their personal life. I mean,
well, you don't. Sorry, it's the Hyde Amendment. Since I think it probably way predates Clinton. I don't know the exact year. It's a very, very old, by that, I mean like probably what, 70s or something, law that says you cannot use federal funding for abortions. Federal dollars don't pay for abortion services, like full stop.
Yes, but listen, you pay taxes, goes to the federal thing. Now the state controls whether or not it's doled out to the states, right? So now the state can control whether it wants to allot that to abortion.
No,
so
it never it can't. It really... cannot, the state can't control that. It cannot go to abortion full stop. Like full stop, it cannot go to abortion. That's not on the table because it's been outlawed for a very long time.
Right. What's happening here is that.
Okay.
Right. What's happening here is even though none of the federal funding can go specifically towards abortion, if anybody does an abortion, even one abortion a year, they can't get the funding that they are allowed to get. And so your taxpayer dollars will never pay for an abortion, but they could go to a agency or a facility that provides them, but not with your funding.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And I found this on PBS. Okay. So under federal law, and I'm quoting this, under federal law, taxpayer dollars cannot fund most abortions, but Title X funding could pay for other family planning services at clinics which separately provide abortions. The vote on Thursday means states can now block the funding for other family planning services at clinics which also provide abortions.
Right, right.
So
So clinics that also, so not for abortions, but clinics that also do that, they can refuse to pay for any services there.
Right. So if a clinic does like one or two abortions a year, then it's like the funding for, like they could possibly withhold funding for all of their services. And that is the problem.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I you know, here's the other thing. I'm not a subject matter expert, but I do know that I think members of Congress are exposed to information and statistics and data, and they are capable of looking at whether or not something's a priority and how to put that in line. And I don't think it's like this big apocalyptic cut and, you know, let's just like.
But it will be, and I'll tell you why.
In the state. That's the goal.
This gender.
No, they're open. They're very open that their goal here is to make abortion harder to get. And one way to do that is to allow states that are against abortion is
coercive.
Let them defund. Yeah, their goal is to shut down abortion providing clinics. That is the end goal.
Well, my punchline is this, okay, it will now be up to the states to decide if abortion providers can get this funding. And so to me, it doesn't really change much because Planned Parenthood works. I mean, of course, they have the federal, they try to vet federal, you know, federal agencies, but then, or try to vet or get federal funding. But ultimately, it's better to have that local control and be able to reach your local state reps. And they always tout the local community empowerment thing. So this doesn't really change that much.
I mean, look, there's the potential of the damage that this kind of law could do, which, for example, 97% of the other services could be impacted. I'm talking about contraception. Well, you know, you don't want people to get abortions and give them some contraception. If they can't have access to contraception, what do you want? What do you think is going to happen? We're going to see a rise in STDs. We're going to see a rise
in
pregnancies.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and maybe none of it will come to pass, but the fact that like those possibilities are not being considered, and it's also a group of overwhelming like men who are making decisions is concerning to me. It's concerning to me whether it happens here, whether it happens in Afghanistan. Like we as a country, like we're kind of blind to our own like misogyny, but we're always talking about, but what about ISIS? What about Taliban?
Well, I think that's going too far. I'm just trying to point
it's going
out
a little far.
This bill is about abortion in particular, not about the entire issue of women's reproductive health. Which
but you know what's interesting? But let me just say this. I have to say this because Sara, you and I are both Muslim. So in Muslim theology, abortions are actually permitted up until the fourth month, okay? So I bet you the Taliban has more relaxed.
You mean the fourth? Yeah.
4 months, right? It's 4 months. So it's, I was going to say the Taliban might be actually more permissive about abortion than the GOP. I don't know, but
They probably are.
Well, here's the thing. I think you're right that this issue has been highly politicized, but it's also being politicized by the GOP. And I think that that it's actually going to impact, and I don't know what, this is where I don't understand. Well, how come their own voters don't see how their community is going to be impacted, how they're receiving services from Planned Parenthood that are not abortion services, that those might also be on the chopping block, and what that's going to do for people, especially if healthcare is also up in the air, right? They can't afford healthcare. It could just be one big disastrous cluster F.
I'm curious.
Go ahead.
Yes. Susan is curious. Go ahead.
No, what goals do you think that are being served here? I mean, it's a very specific issue. It doesn't provide more state flexibility or more state funding in any other area. It's a purely anyone who provides abortions can be screwed financially bill. So what's the like the legislative intent here?
I think it's also philosophical in the sense that, you know,
it's ideological.
It shouldn't be under the purview of the federal government. It's a state issue. It's giving the states back their rights or their ability to work with the citizens, essentially.
It's their money, yeah, but it's not their money.
But also, Sara, I mean, why should anybody else who is not a member of your religion be held hostage to your religious beliefs? Like, I don't understand why.
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying anyone should believe it. I'm just saying that I think if you go by state laws, you're allowed to consider your own religious beliefs. Like Catholics would consider the canon law on it, and Jews would consider the halakha on it, and Muslims might consider their own set of laws over it. So, you know, you're allowed to do, in terms of domestic beliefs, you're allowed to practice your religion freely. But I would apply that to myself. I'm not saying that I push that on anyone else. They might not belong to the same standard or faith, you know, belief as me. I'm just saying, personally, I just don't feel any woman's completely pro-choice or completely pro-life, and, you know, there's nothing in between. And I sometimes feel that everyone, again, is so dogmatic. They're either one or the other, or you're just weird or just, you know.
No, I agree with you there. I just don't think that it's a matter of black and white to say that women should be able to get comprehensive health care. And if the only agency provides healthcare there also provides 3% of their services towards abortions, they can't get any more.
Yeah, I think
That's not. It's not just hurting abortion. It's hurting women who want to get health care and are limited in options. And, you know, sorry, the place you wanted to go and could go does abortion sometimes.
It's going to hurt. It's going to mostly. Healthcare. Yeah, it's going to mostly hurt women who are not there for abortions. Basically, that's the bottom
questions,
line.
There's two questions I had that I noted down in while I was looking at this, and one is basically, do people start moving between states to get it done in places that have facilities that are well funded, and then what they actually happens to the quality of the safety and sanitary conditions, and you know, especially for teens and unintended pregnancies. So, you know, I get all that, but I just don't think this is as bad as everyone's. Seems to think. And honestly, I'm for family values, but at the same time, I think we're all pretty much on the same page as females that, you know, every case is different and there has to be some basic provisions for a woman's needs. And
what these kind of laws end up doing, though, is that abortions become much later in term, much more expensive, much harder to get because it's much hard. It just practically, it becomes such a horrible hassle to get it that women can't, like, it is beyond their means to get abortions at the early stage. By the time they have the money together, by the time they have travel plans together, by the
it's
time they have a place to stay, it's either too late or we're now talking about a very late stage abortion.
Yeah, but you're getting into stuff that states can deal with.
All right, we have had a very, very robust, not just discussion, but disagreement on lots of different things this episode and past ones, which takes me to two of the calls that caught my ear this week. So let's play these listener calls.
Hi, Rabia. Hi, Susan. This is Kayla from Minnesota, and I just wanted to let you know I love you guys, and I would follow you wherever and listen to whatever, but I have to say, listening to the 45th on my morning commute is killing me. The hypocrisy of the Republican view just kills me. I can't understand how they don't see issues with all of these things. I guess that's why we have sour grapes on the Democratic side, because we're still mourning our loss of just general human decency. But whatever. Anyway, have a great time. Thanks for picking the issues and getting to the truth.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate the 45th pod. I really like the recent discussions and being able to listen to both sides without screaming my head off.
All right, so these calls, now it's not about the substance of anything we've talked about. It's not about an issue, but it's about the reaction kind of to our podcast that's kind of fascinating to me. And one listener has said, basically, she's having trouble listening to the podcast because it's so hard for her to deal with the conservative voice and the conservative angle on the issues. Whereas the other listener says, well, I really appreciate the fact that it's well-rounded and you guys are having reasonable discussions and debates without it getting kind of crazy. And we've had the same reaction online. It's really interesting on social media and Twitter and emails. It's like, on one hand, you have the people who reach out. Half the people are like, I can't take it. I cannot deal with listening to Sarah's views.
And both sides. I've seen people who are definitely like, dude, Sarah is amazing, which she is. And then they add up with, but I can't listen to Susan and Rabia.
Oh, this, now I would say that those are probably the
few of those.
Very few of those, I will say. And I have to, And then on the other hand, you have people who have said, you know, we love the fact that this is basically, you know, all kinds of perspectives are represented and you're having, you know, respectful conversation, even though we completely disagree with one party or the other. But I do want to first say, Sara, props to you.
Yes.
It does take courage because you are getting beat up more than Susan and I are. And I know it's because people are coming to this podcast because they expect a serious critique of Trump. And that's what we do week after week. Whereas you
that's what Sara does, too. It's just she's taking it from a conservative angle.
Right, right. I think that's true.
Well, my thing is most conservative people are just about as varied as liberals. And, you know, you need to be able to hear those voices. They're very quiet right now and they're not being heard because they're not as sexy, I suppose. But somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I've even had messages from people saying, you know, I listened to you and Susan on Undisclosed and I want to listen to you here, but I actually can't do it because they cannot even tolerate just listening to like an hour. And I think that's problematic. And I think that's a sign of how polarized we become because everything's been so politicized and just the rhetoric's been so ugly. But I just want to give a shout out to Sara for sticking in there and for, because, you know, for the most part, it's Susan and I end up, kind of disagreeing with you on a lot of things. But
there's
but,
two that really strike me. There was one that I woke up in the morning. It was really, it made me smile. It says, I can't take what Sarah says. I want to pick up my laptop and smash it. And then I realize it's an expensive machine, so I don't. And well, then there's another, there's another really nice one that says, you know, I liked your show and even my Republican mom's listening.
See, that's actually the one that I was going to talk about. Yeah,
that's high praise right there.
Yeah, that I saw that tweet. I thought it was great because the person who tweeted us, the woman, she's liberal and she's like, you know, I got my Republican mother to listen to it and she loves it too. So thank you. Keep listening. Bring your moms and your dads and your grandpas and everybody else. Moving on to another listener message.
Did we get any crank calls? Like any like one just called up just to like rant and rave? Because that'd be awesome.
I don't think yet. No, not yet. It's coming, but not yet.
I think we have one question from somebody asking about money and politics, and that's an ongoing issue. Campaign finance reform.
So let's listen to that listener's message.
Hello, Rabia, Susan, and Sarah. Love the show. Big fan of Undisclosed and followed you guys over here. I just had a question about what you guys think about money and politics and how it influences our congressmen and the Senate if you think that maybe a public funded elections would be more, you know, more fair, that way they had to answer to the actual people that they represent than the actual, you know, people that are donating to them. So I was wondering what your guys' thoughts about that is and how you would think to go about doing that if maybe get an amendment to the Constitution bypassing the House and Senate and going through the states. So, love the show, and thank you.
Okay, so just my layman's take on that is it's still a problem, but it's only a problem because I think the Supreme Court has struck down the limits using First Amendment rights. So what the story is the Federal Elections Commission set up in 1975, and what it does is it requires a disclosure of campaign contributions and campaign expenses, and it puts a cap on how much you can give from a federal level. So their jurisdictions mostly over House, Senate, President, Vice Presidential campaigns. So it's only on federal funds. Now, states vary. Like here in the state of Virginia, there's no limit to what you can give on any of the races in this area. So yes, it does get messy. And yes, the General Assembly here is fighting to have campaign finance reform at a state level as well. The two cases in the Supreme Court was in 2010 and more recently in 2014, where the Supreme Court was able to say people should be, you know, allowed by the First Amendment, their rights in the First Amendment to support whoever they want. And so that's been a push and a pull between, you know, the Federal Elections Commission and the Supreme Court. It's an ongoing thing. It becomes a problem, but there are caps that have been set. So single contributions cannot be more than $5,000 for statewide office in Virginia and $1,000 for the General Assembly positions like Congress people, and then $500 from any other office. So it depends on what your state laws are, but the federal government does have restrictions. You need to look up what they are for your own state.
But I thought super PACs don't have limitations. I thought super PACs can make as many, you know, unlimited number of contributions and amount to federal campaigns.
Well, no? The PACs are limited to 500, and individual is 2,700 at the federal level. So I don't know where the super PAC thing is right now. I haven't been keeping a tab on it just because I do legislation, but my eyes are like spread over 50 million issues at one time. So yeah,
story of the nation.
Yeah, I mean, look, Citizens United is the Supreme Court case that found that, you know what, corporations have First Amendment rights too, and they are citizens too. And it is the corporate money in elections that I think that this gentleman was concerned about. I have the same concern. I do think it's corporate money and also, money by super rich people. And they are, through super PACs, able to funnel millions and millions and tens of millions of dollars that cancel out the concerns and the contributions of people who cannot afford to have that much influence using their money over politicians. The second thing that I think it does, and I don't know if other people feel the same way, is it allows for these incredibly protracted campaigns that go on for like years. You know, I feel like the presidential campaign especially, these campaigns are exhausting. They They go on for so long, and it's because they have the money to go on that long. And, you know, there's certain places, I think it's in the UK, where I don't know if it's for, like, for parliamentary elections or it's for, like, municipal elections, but they have actually a limit, and we should think about this. I really think we should think about this as a country, a limit to how long the campaigns can run. They have, like, 2 weeks. You've got 2 weeks, that's it, that you're allowed to campaign in, or a month. We should not have 18-month-long campaigns that are fueled by these tens of millions of dollars. They burn us out. They polarize us. And I just think we end up in a continuous cycle. I mean, the president has won and he's still campaigning.
Yeah. My husband's Australian. And when he got to America and saw that we spend basically one fourth plus of our lives during campaign season, he was shocked. Because in Australia, it's kind of like get in, get out, you're done. It's very quick. I don't know if it's 2 weeks, but it's not long at all.
Yeah, but back to the question from the listener. There is a bipartisan campaign reform it has been happening as a McCain-Feingold Act where, so it's an issue that concerns both sides. I just feel like there's more leeway at a state level than the federal. So in some ways it's still a struggle at the federal, but I think states have to be more alert just because they have, like Virginia has unlimited.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me like either party really wants to get the big money out of the game. I think that they're both well served by it. But
they both
then,
want it.
Yeah, but then you
Everyone
look at campaign. Yeah, but you have campaigns run like President Obama's campaign and Bernie Sanders. Like they really most of their contributions came from small donors, and so there are ways to still get tremendous amounts of support and be able to run very successful campaigns without the big funding and the lobbies that line their pockets. So,
and this reminds me of our last chat about who's going to be in the Supreme Court to swing these kinds of issues.
Yeah, we're still stuck in Gorsuch.
There's a lot going on here, but I feel like transparency is the biggest battle there. You can argue about the amounts given and all that, but the fact that it's often very much obscured where the money's even coming from is the most important threat to us right now.
Really,
well, you can track all that stuff now. It's
you can,
all online. It's
but really... there's ways around that.
Yeah. But I also think, I've seen it so many times. I've seen that, the Koch brothers. Is it Koch? Koch? I don't even know. Koch brothers? Koch brothers?
I just read it.
Koch. Koch, yeah. I've seen so many times where the Koch brothers have donated this many tens of millions. Like you read these numbers all the time, and it just doesn't faze anybody anymore. It's like, oh, okay, well, I guess that's where their interests lie, and that those are their politics. But even when there is transparency, and you do know that these certain big funders are giving money here and there, it's people just shrug and say, oh, okay, it's become par for the course. This is our political game now. But I do think I agree with the caller that I think that it is problematic, and at the end of the day, a vote is a vote, but a vote doesn't necessarily mean that if you voted for somebody, they're going to care. They're going to be representing your interests. They will. I think that money means that they'll be representing the interests of their donors, their big donors. That's my concern.
I was going to say that might have been what we saw in November 2016.
Or every election. I don't think
every election.
I don't think that 2016. It was notable for a lot of reasons. I don't think 2016 was unique in that respect.
Yeah. It's been ongoing. All right, guys. Thanks so much for a great discussion. And we will see our listeners in a week. And hope that you guys tweet at us, send us messages. We get emails and definitely leave some voicemails. We'd love to play your voicemail on our next episode. Bye, guys. Thanks again to all our listeners for joining us this week on the 45th Podcast. You can find us online on both Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is 45thpod.com, and you can leave us your messages, your thoughts, your suggestions, feedback, and even your angry rants at 202-670-8345. Again, that is 202-670-8345. You will find us on Audioboom and iTunes. We ask that you please subscribe, rate, and share with others. Also, a big shout out and thanks to everyone who makes this show possible, our fabulous sponsors, our executive producer, Meetal Delhan. Our audio production is by Ray Gaines, and we are a production of the Long Arc Digital Media Company. See you guys next week.
Okay, so to give you my layman's perspective on it, it primarily campaign finance reform means that...
Y'all, can I just tell you a really horribly awkward story?
Go ahead.
I was just trying to open... the voicemail and listen to it, and I was not paying attention because I was listening to Sara, and I clicked on the number, and my computer just called them.
Oh my god.
Yeah. It's like 10:30 at night.
Did you hang
up?
I
know. I just like hung up really quickly. Like, oh my god, sorry.
That would be kind of fun, though. We just like make crank. We make crank calls to our listeners.
Yes. We'll preempt the crank callers by crank calling them ourselves.
Nice. High five.
Sorry, continue.
I can't stop laughing. Okay, wait. Okay. My layman's take on that is it's still a problem.